Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
And remember, the secret word is jelly chicken. Just remember that.
Is he asking about this food?
It's all pre-bomb, all of it. It's safe as anything. Why do we have to keep waiting for the old man? Why don't we just take our chances with it?
We already took chances. The old man told us not to plant on the north acreage, that it was poisonous. This is what came up.
Did these grow, Evie? Or did somebody leave them to us in a will?
They were the best.
The best? I just see the worst.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Come on, Mr. Goldsboro, why don't you tell us how disappointed you are, huh?
Oh, Mr. Goldsmith, you are kook. You know that?
You've got enough food in that pile over there to feed us all for a good long time.
There's enough poison in those cans to kill us all in 10 days. Most of it was canned after the bomb. We've no idea where it came from. Who processed it?
All right, let's lay it on the line there, Mr. Goldsmith. Here now. Come on, who'd like a nice square meal for a change, huh? Anybody else? Dig in.
Forgot the chief method of execution. We forgot faithlessness, Major French. Maybe you're not to blame. Maybe if it weren't you, it would have been someone else. Maybe this has to be the destiny of man. I wonder if that's true. I wonder.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end.
Open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. We'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, 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 everybody. Good afternoon. Yes, it is Talking Twilight Zone. I'm your host, Lynn. And we are here today, of course, with my co-host, with Robert and Dave. and Bobby. And we have our wonderful guests here, our loyal guests, Rick Wall. We have Louie. And we have guest eight. And we have Felix. Hello, Felix. I'm so glad to see you here. And guest nine is here as well. So we have a full house today. This is just great. And
someone has poisoned the water hole. Everybody.
And before I get started, I should have done this a while back, and I do want to do this now. I want to thank you, Robert, for always doing these excellent, excellent introductions before the show.
Well, the center one, Siberian Nights, was one from my youth when I was in college back in 82. That came out during a time, I don't know if you remember a song called White Horse.
Yes.
It came out about the same time. It was Catch 22 was the name of the group. So.
Well, you always
thank
do
you.
A fabulous job. You always do a great beginning, appropriate songs, and you put a lot of time and effort into that, and I really appreciate it, and I think we all do. So thank you so much. Woo!
Yeah, I enjoy Morrison. I thought that was a good song.
Yeah, that was a good one. At the end, I love that because I always liked that song. But yes, okay, so we're here today, and it's a beautiful day here in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania, and I'm sure that it's a beautiful day in New York, isn't it, Rick?
Yeah, a little cloudy, but all right.
Yeah, I've got a few clouds, but it's a little sunshine, and hi, Guest 10. Guest 10 came in, too, and I'm hoping everybody
got more rain than I did last night.
We got a lot of rain last week, but now it's...
No, I mean Jersey. Well, between 6 and I'd say about 8 or 9, we got torrential rain. But up here, but from what I heard on the news in Jersey, they got floods.
Whoa! Mm-hmm. No, Felix says it's raining where he. Felix, where are you again? I'm sorry, that's stupid.
Look at his name, and you can figure it out, Lynn.
Okay.
Welcome to our neighborhood, boys and girls.
Stupid is a stupid dog. Okay.
Life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you'll find.
Felix in New Jersey. Yes, Felix is in New Jersey, and it's raining there right now.
And now here's Ollie Williams with the weather forecast. Ollie?
It's going to rain!
Thanks, Ollie.
Okay, but it's beautiful sunshine here right now. And, you know, Rick's in New York. I know he's not in, you know, downtown New York, but I'm sure he's having... How about you, Dave? I know it rains a lot there, but how's it right now?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit cold and rainy the last couple of days, but we had a lovely start to May. It's been really nice. Lovely weather, but unfortunately, it's just... dropped off a little bit this last couple of days.
And Louie, you're in New York too, right?
Yeah. Brooklyn.
Yeah, so you're having nice weather. I know that. Sunshine, right?
No, it's cloudy. It's been on and off with rain.
Well, yeah.
Last night there was was there a thunderstorm around the area? I can't remember.
There were about 5 thunderstorms here, so you must have gotten a few too.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah, last night we had thunder and lightning here. Yeah, remember, Bobby, we had thunder and lightning here?
Let's go live to Ollie Williams with the weather report. Ollie?
It's raining sideways!
Sounds rough, Ollie. Do you have an umbrella?
Had one!
Where is it?
Inside out, 2 miles away!
Is there anything we can do for you?
Bring me some soup!
What kind?
Turkey!
All right, we'll get on that.
Bobby?
Yeah, what? I'm just sitting here waiting for the show to begin.
I didn't mean to wake you up. I'm sorry.
It's 13 minutes into the show. We haven't done a thing yet.
We're talking, man. This, you know, he's our timekeeper. We all know he's our timekeeper, right? No, but he remembers.
Well, this is a little late.
Oh, my. All right. Okay. This is our timekeeper. Okay. Well, anyway, today we are talking about the old man in the cave, and that's our episode for today. And I'm going
to
turn
Lynn, you know, to tie into this episode, you know, they canceled a TV show on CBS. You remember what it was called?
Time Traveler, right?
Nope. It was called Intelligence. Thank you. which this one kind of lacked in this episode, but anyway.
No, I did not.
Nothing to see. Well, move along. Move along.
All right, move along. Move along. Okay. Well, it's over to you now, darling, because you've got the opening.
And now, Mr. Serling.
What you're looking at is a legacy that man left to himself. A decade previous, he pushed his buttons, and a nightmarish moment later, woke up to find that he had set the clock back 1,000 years. His engines, his medicines, his science were buried in a mass tomb, covered over by the biggest gravedigger of them all, a bomb. And this is the Earth 10 years later, a fragment of what was once a whole, a remnant of what was once a race. The year is 1974, and this is the Twilight Zone.
Yes, it is. It is the Twilight Zone. Yeah, we have an episode here. We have a sparsely populated town, and it's supposed to be 10 years after a nuclear war. And it supposedly devastated the United States. So the townspeople, they discovered a supply of canned food. I guess that jelly chicken or fish or whatever. And they're waiting for Mr. Goldsmith to return with a message from the mysterious and unseen old man in the cave who tells them whether the food is contaminated with radiation or whether they can eat it. So, you know, of course, some of the townsfolk, they're hungry. Come on, they're hungry. They want to take their chances. They want to eat the food. But they don't do it because after seeing the disastrous harvest that was yielded when they failed to take his advice, they just backed off. They said, well, we're not going to eat it, you know, because they saw the areas were contaminated. So Mr. Goldsmith, of course, he's the town leader now. He's played by John Anderson. He's the town's leader. And he returns and he informs the people that the old man has declared that the food is contaminated and it should be destroyed. Well, it's not long after that, just shortly after that, this group of soldiers enters the town led by Major French, not Mr. French. Mr. French was a family affair. Major French.
Would you like to have a tonic with
the bathroom cabinet, right? Bathroom cabinet. Right. Major French. And he clashes. They butt heads, you know, as they try to establish the authority. You know, Goldsmith's been the leader of the group all this time, and the soldiers, they may or may not be representatives of the U.S. government, and Goldsmith claims that they're just a wandering pack of military men who are intruding on the town and trying to establish authority. And French, Major French, he reveals that there are maybe 500 people left alive between Buffalo, New York, and Atlanta, Georgia. 500 people. And he talks of small, isolated, primitive societies on the shores of Lake Erie and what used to be Chicago. And he claims that his job is to organize the region so that society can be rebuilt. And Goldsmith believes that French and his men are complete asses and want to strip the town of their food. So, you know, you have your clash there, the clash of wills. You know, remember, what was the episode on Thursday we leave for home? You know, you've got the two leaders. One wants, they all, you know, they're butting heads. One wants to be in charge, the other wants to be in charge. So you got, you know, the clash of wills. And so, what's his name? Major French there. He's frustrated with Goldsmith. So he tries to tell the townspeople that the infallible old man in the cave who gives them all this advice is, he's doesn't exist. You know, he tries to tempt them with some of the food that Goldsmith claims was contaminated. And they should throw caution to the wind and you know, eat this food. And everybody except Goldsmith eventually consumes the food and they drink the drink. And Goldsmith falls into disfavor among the townspeople because he's not doing what they're doing. So anyway, to make a long story short, Goldsmith was bullied and threatened by French and his men. So he finally, you know, he opens the cave door, basically because they all ran and the whole town just ran and busted the thing open. And it's ultimately revealed that in reality, the townsfolk have been listening to a computer the whole time. So in a fit of rage at being deceived, the people of the town, they destroy the computer. And as Mr. Goldsmith had insisted, the old man was correct. Because without his authority telling them what to do, the entire human population of the town, including the soldiers, die horribly, except for the one lone survivor, Mr. Goldsmith.
When we talked about the ways that men could die, we forgot the chief method of execution. We forgot faithlessness, Major French. Maybe you're not to blame. Maybe if it weren't you, it would have been someone else. Maybe this has to be the destiny of man. I wonder if that's true. I wonder.
Reminds you of a lot of other episodes where there was one survivor. You know, that the one with Claude Akins, was it? Claude Akins, where they're, you know, he
time
runs.
Enough.
Oh yeah, time enough at last. And the one with Claude Akins where he's on the planet, the little people. Where he takes off without the guy. He wants to, you know, rule this group of little people, this little society he found, but then he ends up being the lone survivor and then gets crushed at the end. And, you know, there's a lot of them like that, you know. But it's another one of Rod Serling, to me, anyway, it's another one of Rod Serling's cautionary tales of nuclear warfare. And I think everybody can agree with that. It seemed to be one of his favorite subjects. I mean,
well, it's kind of like a flip side of two, where we had two in the city, this is in the country, so you could equate it to the same thing that might have happened, but you see what happened out in the country instead of what happened in the city.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a favorite subject. I mean, you have time enough at last, you have the shelter, you have there from the sun, you have two, you have one more pallbearer. They're all examples of Rod's obsession with, you know, nuclear war. And
Not just Rod's.
Well, no, not just Rod. I agree with you there. But, I mean, he did have, you know, kind of an obsession with that, which was fine because of just about all the episodes that he did on this subject, you know, Time Enough at Last that I mentioned, The Shelter and Two, and, I mean, they were all great episodes.
How old are you, if I may ask, Lynn?
What's that?
How old are you, if I may ask?
I'm 55.
Okay, so then you remember going under under the desks. Okay.
Duck and cover. Well, duck and cover.
Yep. Duck and cover.
Well, Rod was not the only one obsessed with it. I mean, I remember at like 8 years old talking about bombs dropping.
Well, wasn't Ray Bradbury? He also, I think, wrote quite a few stories on, maybe not a lot, but he wrote a few stories on nuclear war, Ray Bradbury.
Yep.
And they had a film out called Duck and Cover that they played
That's
in
right.
school to show you what to do in case of a nuclear war.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. So they're all examples of, you know, his, you know, that he liked to tell these stories and caution us about nuclear warfare. John Anderson, say Goldsmith. You know, he was the leader of the isolated group of survivors. You know, he claimed to get his instructions from the old man in the cave, but nobody ever sees this man except for Goldsmith. Major French, played very well by James Coburn. He rolls in the town with his group and starts throwing his weight around. Soon after, the townspeople, you know, they turn on Goldsmith and put their faith in French. Well, you know, it makes sense. You know, you're hungry. You want to eat. You want to drink. You know, you're hungry. You're going to try to go with the person who's going to feed you and help you survive. You know, and the tension, as I said, was reminiscent of that between Captain Benteen and Colonel Sloan on Thursday We Leave From Home. Thursday We Leave For Home. So French, the rest of the folks, they take off like wild animals. They pursue the old man. It turns out to be a computer. And I suppose it was a pretty sophisticated unit for 1963, but, you know, the people quickly attacked it. And it's pretty interesting that it was still operating 10 years after electricity was supposedly gone because it was a nuclear holocaust. So, You know, also, where do you find an electrical outlet in a cave? I don't know about that either. But and another thing I wonder about is how Goldsmith became the only one privileged enough to know about the computer. Maybe he built it. We never find out where it came from. They don't tell us anything. You know? I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions in the story. I don't understand why Rod left us in the dark about so many details, but I guess we can't totally blame him.
No, they do say, because he's the leader of the town, and he knew it's part of his knowledge that was written by the other leaders in the town.
But where did it come from, the computer?
That we don't know.
That's my
point.
We
don't know. That's the thing.
That's the thing. We don't know whether he built it. You know, we don't know. We don't know because he left us in the dark about that. But I can't blame him. Remember, I don't know. I guess some of you know. Some of you don't. He adapted this from a short story by a gentleman named Henry Slezar. Still, he could have worked his magic and filled in the gaps for us, but he didn't. But I thought it, in the very beginning, I thought it moved a little bit slowly. And townsfolk just, they kind of moped around looking real shabby, you know, because they were hungry and, you know, they didn't have much. You know, you didn't know if they lived in the street, did they have homes, you didn't know anything. But I always enjoy seeing John Anderson. I think he's terrific. I love everything he's been in. And it was his fourth and last own appearance. James Coburn, he gave a good performance, you know. And it was nice to see John Morley again. And the last time we saw him was in Kick the Can. He played the manager or the keeper of, remember Kick the Can, the old folks home?
Mm-hmm.
The nursing home, yeah. He played the caretaker there. And, you know, this was his last appearance, but I thought it was a decent episode. I really did. It was good acting. A few flaws, you know, like not knowing where the computer came from or anything. But you know, other than that, I'm giving it a 2.5 because I thought it was above average. I really did. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Robert.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. Yeah, I was kind of when my rating around a 2. I was thinking between a 2, 2.5 myself, like you said, but. Pretty much, it's a repeat, as you said, Lynn, work version of On Thursday We Leave for Home from season 4. And actually, instead of just having been teen-type person in this story, which deemed the computer, but Anderson's character as well, putting control on the community there. I mean, they were dying anyway. You were talking about how slow and they were moving, stuff like that. I mean, you know, you got radiation. So it is, you know, slowly killing these townspeople.
Yeah.
And then you throw in James Corbin's character, French, as the catalyst for the town's destruction later on. I mean, we truly don't know if he is in the military or he just swiped some clothes and put him on to say he was. But he did admit towards the end of the episode that he was in college. So, but there again. And he's a character we don't know. You can't take what he says to be the absolute truth. I mean, some people might have been dishwashers and then make themselves out as colonels or whatever because there's so much chaos in the world during that time. You don't know who's who. So we just kind of say, well, he says he is, so maybe he was. But the problem with this episode, it does bring up a lot of questions. I mean, for example, the power source of the computer in the cave. If you remember the Planet of the Apes TV series,
uh-huh.
There was an episode where they went into, I think it was a cave or something like that, and they find some kind of device or a train depot somewhere. I think it was a train depot where there was some knowledge that was hidden. And the power source was a can of acid, I think it was, that was connected to the hologram. It was trying to tell them that there are certain places where things were hidden. So,
yeah, it was, I believe it was a subway station in New York.
Right, yeah.
And, yeah, it was like an old battery, that, you know, like the, one of the first batteries that had a barrel with two electrodes and, I guess, acid in it and water. Yeah.
So they could have had batteries or, you know, that was running the computer. You just didn't see where they were. But
yeah.
You know, cars didn't run, so they had to be pulled by horses. They said that's because when radiation goes off, it kind of blocks the impulses of electric, kind of like the from L.A. situation. Remember where Snake sets off the program on the thing and it puts off and it cuts off all electric around the world.
Right.
You know, something like that.
It was an electromagnetic pulse. He punched in 666. I think that was
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all the electricity in the world goes out.
And also we have a TV series that was canceled, I think, called Evolution, Revolution.
Oh, yeah, Revolution. Did it get canceled? I didn't
Yeah, know. It did. It didn't get picked up for a third season. So, and that was kind of the same thing. Electric got cut off, and you got to see the devastation of the apocalypse during that time. Another thing, too, did a central government really exist, or were they a splintered militia self-formed type society? I mean, in Revolution, they tried to have some kind of government still in Washington going, but I kind of wondered about with this episode, too. French says he's been over, and he estimated that the survivors are 500 people, as we see, as I mentioned earlier, the horse-pulled cars in town. The good question is, so how was he able to get gas for his Jeep with no electric to pump gasoline out?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah, but you know, in other movies, you've seen them use suction where they siphon out the put in the vehicles. There's a good show called Under the Dome, which is starting back up next month. And you see one that's cut off from society and it's under the dome. And that's what they ended up doing, siphoning gas from other cars. The Walking Dead is another example. So, I mean, there's a lot of apocalyptic movies you can put into this. Of course, I like James Coburn in this story. He was great in the Flint movies. And the military uniform he wore in this story was similar to the uniform he wore as a disguise in one of the Flint movies.
He was a terrific actor. He really was.
Yeah, it's the late James Coburn. He passed away some time ago.
Did you ever notice that so many people confuse him with Lee Marvin? Lee Marvin and James Coburn, they always get confused. I don't know.
Lee Marvin was older than Coburn
was.
Yeah,
but for some reason, people confuse them all the time. I guess because of the white hair and the grizzly kind of look that they have.
And the gruff voice.
Yeah, the gruff voice. I've confused them many times. I'm like, wasn't that Lee Marvin? No, that was James Coburn. You know, was that James Coburn? No, that was Lee Marvin. Yeah, I can't remember.
Another question I had was also come up as, would you want to live in a hell like this or eat the contaminated food and die? Now, suicide, this kind of comes into question because of the intelligence of the people. Were they really committing suicide because they acted like they didn't really know for sure if the food's contaminated, even though Rod says at the end it was.
Are you doubting Rod?
Well, just listen to what this woman
Are you
said.
Doubting Rod's word?
Is he asking about this food?
It's all free bomb, all of it. It's safe as anything.
See, she says she believes it's safe. I guess a lot of people.
Well, Rod
it was
said
safe.
It's not.
And it wouldn't be.
That's right.
That's right. That's where the intelligence comes in. So did they really commit suicide or just what's the word I'm trying to think of? Just they didn't have the knowledge or the foresight to think about, well, if the cans aren't lined with lead, which you could die from lead poisoning, most of those cans are tin, and you know they ain't going to hold out radiation. So, like I said, there's just a lot of questions to this.
Yeah, exactly. Unanswered questions.
So, I give it a 2 out of 5.
Well, not really, because back then they thought that we would survive a nuclear war, which we all know we won't.
Okay, the word I'm looking for is ignorance. Did they just die of ignorance more than suicide?
Yeah, I kind of understand.
Like the Jim Jones thing, yeah.
I think that's the references we're making.
Yeah. So what did you give it up? I'm sorry, Robert?
A 2 out of 5. I give it average. I was trying to bait, as I said earlier, between a 2, 2.5.
Yeah.
I pretty much stick with a 2. I'll pass it on to Bobby. Bobby?
All righty. Well, same old, same old. Another interesting premise turned into sheer nonsense. I gave it a 3. I have no idea. I must have been drunk that day or something. I don't know what was wrong with me.
Drinking that poison alcohol there, Bobby.
Yeah, because you always said you liked this episode.
Well, I would have liked it if it had been done with any intelligence, but it's so full of holes, it's ridiculous. First of all, the idea that starting it out by Rod Serling giving his narration and saying that it's 10 years later is ridiculous, because what it does is it takes the edge off the entire story. They've survived 10 years. Why should I worry about them? If they've survived 10 years, they'll probably get the rest of the way. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Aside from the fact that nobody could possibly survive 10 years that way, it is science fiction, but still, I mean, it just takes the edge off the entire story. I have no idea. I mean, he did not write this original story. It's written by somebody else. He simply wrote the screenplay, but even so, 10 years is just ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. And the idea that these people, these survivors, have lasted for 10 years now, all of a sudden, just because some renegade soldiers come along or whatever they're supposed to be, they completely throw everything over. I realize it's a half-an-hour story and you're on a fast track. You know, I haven't got the time to tell a long story. Reality is, as much as I hate hour-long stories, if there should have been an hour-long story, it should have been this one, because there's a lot not explained that should have been. But they're on a fast track, and we just want to get to the end, which is that everybody's going to die. So it doesn't have to make any sense. But I don't like that idea. Now, aside from that, is the fact that not eating the right food is the last of your problems. If you're the smallest of your problems, if you're a survivor of a nuclear war, that's not the only thing that'll kill you. I mean, for one thing, they're all talking about food, but you can live for a while without food. You can't live 10 years, obviously, but you can live for a while without food. You can't live without water. Water will kill you in no time at all, and you don't need to have nuclear war for that. So the real issue here is water, not food. And the idea that these people listened to this one man all this time, and the proof is in the pudding, the fact that they're still alive, and then these soldiers come along, and just like that, in about 5 minutes on screen, they managed to talk everybody into to breaking in this cave and destroying the computer. It just doesn't make any sense. And it's just simply not believable in any way, shape, or form. So I think it was rude early for me. It really was. I think it is an interesting premise, but it's just too silly. It just doesn't add up to anything. And it's another post-apocalyptic story on the Twilight Zone. This is so ridiculous. It's just agonizing for me to watch this series just keep on pulling old ideas out over and over and over again. And as Robert already said and said in his review, you know, it's just, you know, we've seen this before, you know, on Thursday with Ephraim and stuff like that. We've seen all this. And so there's really no surprises. What is going to be the surprise? There really isn't going to be one. So that's
so, Bobby,
really
is this the last apocalyptic one we go through?
No, there's one more. Probe 7 over and out comes up in about a month, and that's where the astronaut goes to another planet, and while he's there, there's a nuclear war, and now he's the only one left there. And you don't need to have a brain to figure out where that's going. So,
you know what, though? You know, excuse me,
what?
I'm sorry. But Dave just mentioned something, and I didn't even think about that until now. There were no kids there. Did you notice there were no young people? They were all adults. No children.
You can point to 20 things. I mean,
yeah,
but I'm usually pretty good about that. I give a story a lot of leeway. It doesn't always have to make a lot of sense to be entertaining. I mean, my mother was like that. She would watch something, and then at the end of it, she'd say, "That's ridiculous. That could never happen." But it's a fictional story, so you don't want to go too far with that. Either want a fictional story or a documentary. And so I tend to give a lot of room, but the Twilight Zone is pushing my patience to the limit with this kind of nonsense. It just is absolutely ridiculous. And as already been mentioned here, Serling had an obsession with stories about the end of the world. Now, I don't necessarily put that on him, because that was the tenor of the times, and nuclear war was very much on everybody's mind. And you don't hear about it anymore because we've survived 50 years. So, you know, it's like worrying about a disease. If you don't get it for 50 years, it's time to stop worrying about it. You probably won't get it in your lifetime. So we don't hear about it anymore. But back then, it was over and over and over and over and over again. I went on the Internet just to see if I could find anybody's theory about why there are so many stories about the end of the world. And I found a rather strange little website run by a woman. And it's called antiwar.com. And it's basically what it says. She rails against war, any kind of war, anywhere, for any reason. And to my great surprise, she mentions the Twilight Zone, and I wasn't expecting that. So I just want to read a little bit of what she wrote here. This is from 2009, and this is not from me. I did not write this. This is what she wrote. She wrote, a pop culture curio with more than meets the eye, the Twilight Zone reveals a signpost up ahead, which after 45 years, now 50 years, is still ignored by Americans whose guts tell them to avoid the wretchedness of war, who find themselves in it again and again and again. Now, she wrote this during the 4th of July marathon, which is coming up soon. So it couldn't be more fitting that the Sci-Fi Channel hosted again its annual 4th of July Twilight Zone marathon. More than 60 episodes of Rod Serling's playful and creepy, enigmatic, and ultimately moralistic vignettes of the post-war, which first aired on CBS from 1959 through 64. And as Americans, we struggle valiantly, spill blood, and sacrifice our children for noble causes. This is the final conflict. The button is pushed, and there is an epiphany. No one can possibly win. We wiped them out. They wiped us out, says the command center general on the doomed planet to the lonely astronaut crash-landed millions of miles away in Probe 7 over and out. That's coming up in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. Then the end. Regret, and depending on the episode, grinding despair or a shard of hope, apocalypse and its aftermath were the prevailing, most relentless themes throughout the show's 5-season run, and they are key to understanding the emerging social climate of the early 1960s. One could say Serling and his fellow writers, particularly Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont, deftly plumbed America's bipolar years. The eye-popping, never-stopping JFK-inspired New Frontier meets the Bay of Pigs, homemade bomb shelters, and the old man in the cave. What you're looking at is the legacy that man left to himself. A decade previous, he pushed his button, and a nightmarish moment later, woke up to find that he had set the clock back 1,000 years, goes the narration in 1963's Old Man, aired 1 year after the Cuban Missile Crisis and 3 years after a U.S. spy plane was shot down by the Soviet Union's escalating the Cold War. Here, suicide is man's last chapter as survivors lose faith and ultimately bend to an ignorant thug who, quite like the men who destroyed civilization in the first place, takes them all over the precipice a second and final time. There is the frantic loneliness of a world devoid of life, and where is everybody? Resigning oneself to its coming in the midnight sun, and even the folly of embracing it in time enough at last. There is the beauty in starting over, as when a frightened female, obviously Russian, soldier, sheds the uniform and the baggage of her warrior ethos for a war-fatigued male American soldier with similar baggage in two. And that's the end of what she wrote. And I agree with that. I mean, it really became an obsession on this show. And obviously it did very well. I mean, I watched it and so did millions of other people. And it was very much in the news. It looks a little, it doesn't hold up very well 50 years later because we have other things to worry about besides that. And that's the problem with it. The story itself, like I said, I think it was an interesting premise. So there are just too many holes in it. For instance, these soldiers who come along and tell everybody, oh, stop listening to this computer or the old man in the cave telling you what to do. Go ahead and break open the food and eat it. How is it they survived 10 years if they've been so careless in during their travels across the countryside? What is this leader doing alive? I mean, I'm supposed to believe that they've been running around and eating whatever they want, doing whatever they want all these years, and they're still alive, but now they get here, and now they're going to die from eating everything. Those two things just don't add up. They just don't add up at all. And all these people, then, of course, there's the Twilight Zone problem with having no budget. All of the people in the story, all of the extras look like they just got back from lunchtime on a movie set, which is obviously what they've done. They look way too well-fed. They don't look nearly as bad as they should look after 10 incredible years. So like I said, it's not, you know, it's an interesting premise, and I wish I could look past all the holes in it and like it better than I did. I did give it a 3. because it's mildly interesting if you just don't look too far into it, because when you start doing that, it really does look pretty stupid, to be honest with you. The most interesting thing about the episode for me has nothing to do with the writing, but the way the world turned out. Here's a cautionary tale about turning your life over to a computer and letting it tell you what to do and how to survive. Back then, that was a big deal because nobody owned their own computer. Today, we turn everything over to computers. The computers run the entire world. And it would be the other way around. If the computers decided to not work anymore, we'd be in serious trouble, because I doubt that we even remember how to survive anymore without them. So that's the interesting part of the story, is that the times have changed so much. Like I said, I gave it a 3, and I can't change it now. I mean, I could, but I'll just keep it there for being an interesting premise, but it's got a ridiculous number of holes in it. It's just not believable in any way, and that's too bad. Too many end-of-the-world stories in the Twilight Zone. Time and Lawful Last, you know, it should have stopped right there, because you can't really beat that. And one other thing. I said this in my review on the board. I thought it would have been interesting. Of course, nobody was thinking that way back then. If when the lone survivor walks down the street at the end of the episode and everybody's dead laying in the street, if the camera had pulled back only to find Henry Bemis still sitting on the side of the road, surrounded by folks still crying because his glasses are broken. That would have been like just a little salute back to the past, but of course, they probably didn't want to remind anybody that they've already done this story 25 times. So there you go. They did that. I'll leave it at 3. God only knows why. All right, Lynn.
Okay.
Yeah, Bobby, it would have been funny if you seen the word come up, meanwhile, ... then they go back to me. Yeah,
exactly. Right, right.
Back at the bank vault. Okay. And now we go over to Dave.
Okay, of course, I mean, it was the whole time, wasn't it? I mean, this first aired November 8th, 1963, just about a year, as was said by Bobby there, from the, Cuban Missile Crisis. I think that was something like October 62. This idea about this time, I mean, even in Quantum Leap, they referred to an episode where, you know, he gets a job building shelters, and they were basically making their living on the fear of other people. I must admit, I certainly agree about that. They looked a little bit too well-fed, because the James Coburn character was calling them skeletons, and they all had more fat on them than James Coburn, which was rather strange in that way. This is one of those episodes I loved it for. The quality of acting, the two main leads are James Coburn and John Anderson, and also I actually get a fondness from seeing these guys on the screen again, and realising and remembering what good actors they were, because not all TV acting at the time was of that calibre. But the story was stretched out, and the number of times we heard the old man in the cave. I mean, if the writer was getting a pound or a dollar for every time he put that in the script, he was doing rather well indeed. Again, yes, I actually like time travel programs, and I do like these post-apocalyptic things, not always because of war, but things like the small communities surviving and then, you know, thinking that the world is bad enough, and then the day only gets worse when some jumped up characters come as self-proclaimed, we're your new leaders, you take orders from us now. That happened in the film called The Postman. It happened in the Day of the Triffids TV series, certainly here in the UK, if you saw that, where somebody comes up and declaims that, you know, they're the new authority. Having said that, in The Postman, in actual fact, the main character invents that. That's the one where he actually he finds a crashed aircraft with letters on board, and it's Kevin Costner playing the part. He decides that he sees all these letters, and he thinks if he takes these letters to a nearby town, because that's where the plane had crashed, you know, they might actually feed him. And then he gets the idea of, you know, they give him letters and he goes on to the next town, and he pretends that he's part of a new official authority. So I think they were right to be sceptical of these four guys coming in a Jeep. self-proclaimed military people. They'd obviously had them passing through before.
I did like that line where in The Postman, he was talking to Tom Petty, and Tom Petty goes, "No, you're more important than I am." Remember that one?
Right.
Yeah. But he's The Postman.
Yeah. The thing is that, I mean, it just seems strange that they've got these cans in the village, because obviously they are unaffected by radiation. That's why they've survived. So the actual area in which they're now living didn't have the radiation. But the idea is that this stuff was canned after the bomb, but we don't know where. We don't know how it got to the village. Somebody said in text, and it was one of the things I thought about, was, they don't want to leave the village. They've got nowhere to go, but yet they've got horses pulling the cars. Now, I don't know why they didn't eat them, really. That seemed to be the obvious answer to that, or at least breed them. But on the other hand, when I meant that about no young people and no children, maybe they were affected, maybe they were sterile, maybe... you could argue that part and parcel of their woes was the fact that, you know, they were not just survivors, but maybe the last survivors. You've heard of films like Children of Men and things like that, where people are sterile for whatever reason in the storyline. I think that thing about the writers, of course, is that, not so much now when this was written in the 60s, but there were people that had lived under the threat of nuclear war, certainly, ever since the first bomb had gone off, and Hiroshima and so on. What do I think? The other thing is that, I made a connection with the episode from Series 3, Episode 66-2, with Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery and the jellied chicken... cans and so on.
We'd be talking about jelly chicken today, folks.
Yeah.
That's disgusting. ding, 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 ding. You said the magic word.
Yeah. And the other connection, of course.
That comes down.
Yeah. Of course, the fact that it was James Coburn in that, and we've got, James Coburn in this, Charles Bronson in that. So two members of the Magnificent Seven, one of my favourite Western films of all time. When you talk about the cave and the commuter, that certainly was slightly strange. I thought, by the way, and I think you mentioned it, Lynn, the on Thursday we leave for home. That was series
right.
4, episode 118.
That was a 1-hour episode, yeah.
Yeah, but I think actually that was the same cave. That was the cave where they actually had the meetings inside the cave. The same place. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe there was. I didn't think about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That cave can meet with Doctor Who's quarries and.
Here.
I enjoyed it for the acting. I have a lot of time for those shows. There were a lot of inconsistencies once you started to think, but basically it was what you might call a salutary tale. It was, of man's folly and, will we never learn? But if they aren't going to eat those horses, my ending would have been not to see the chap sitting there with his broken glasses, although that would have been a nice little nod. But I didn't know why. He was the only man left. He had no use for the horses. I mean, he's leaving the bridle to those cows. Why didn't he go and unhook the horses and let them, go off and fend for themselves, maybe even just choose one of them to ride on the back of and leave town on horseback, as all good Westerns should end.
Well, they must have found some viable water somewhere, because the animals wouldn't be alive then. They'd be dead too from the radiation.
Right, indeed. Yeah. But again, it's 4 episodes you said that John Anderson was in. I remember the one with him in the, the pilot of the aircraft.
I'd see it.
The trumpet one. Yeah.
Which one?
the trumpet one with Klugman.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I just enjoyed the acting, basically. I like that sort of premise. So for me, it passed a nice time. But absolutely, Bobby, I do certainly agree. If you actually stop and think about it, there's an awful lot that doesn't hold up. But I would give it a 3 on the strength of that. 2 for the story, 3 for the overall enjoyment of it.
Okay, good. All right, great. Okay, Rick.
Okay, I'm probably going to be laughed at and yelled at as usual, but...
Oh, I would never laugh at you.
I love this episode. Yeah, okay, big deal. A lot of holes. Who cares? Okay.
Well, I care. What do you mean, who cares?
Who cares? Excuse me, fan. Who here has worked for 20 years in the business itself?
Rick.
Me?
Rick doesn't care.
Okay? I don't care.
Rick doesn't care.
All right. This was written by an Emmy and Oscar winner. How many Emmys and Oscars have you won, sir? No answer.
Right,
I guess none.
Hold on.
All right.
Some people just enjoy movies for the entertainment purposes than the story. I think that's part of what you're saying.
The guy that wrote this, Henry Slezar, he won an Oscar and Emmy.
No, I'm talking about the guy who wrote it.
Rod Serling.
He adapted it. Rod Serling.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant the guy who wrote the story itself. Okay.
Yeah, Serling didn't write it. He adapted it.
Yes, from Slezar. Yeah.
He's never mind. Anyway.
Go ahead, Rick.
Get that jelly chicken out of your mouth.
Again, in this business, especially back then, if you weren't a member of the Writers Guild, you didn't get any credits. All right? If the guy was in the Writers Guild, he would have most likely adapted it himself. But, anywho, come on. It's John Anderson. It's James Colbert. How could you go wrong?
It's the horse's head man.
Yeah, the guy with the horse. Yeah, you know, the poor guy woke up with a horse's head in his bed. Poor guy Frank, right?
Yep. I mean, how could you go wrong? Anyway.
That's a damn shame.
I like it. You know, sometimes you have to put your mind in park and just enjoy something.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of sitting there and analyzing it to death. And I liked it. I'd give it a 5.
Wow.
So you put your mind in neutral. That's what I hear from a lot of people. I listen to a lot of podcasts and about movie reviews and stuff, and they pretty much say there are movies you just put your mind in neutral and just go for the ride.
Yep.
So, yep. I understand that. I give 2 a 5, didn't I? I really liked it. I thought it was pretty good.
Which one?
Wasn't 2? Didn't I give 2 a 5? I can't remember all fans.
You gave it a 2 to 2. What? Wait, what did you give?
2.
Either 4 or 5, something like that.
To what?
Episode 2, he gave a 5.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And now here's Ollie Williams with the weather forecast. Ollie?
It's going to rain!
Thanks, Ollie.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I mean,
ignore
that one
me,
has
please,
holes
me,
in it, too. Well, you know, I like that.
I think a lot of it
is the characters, like, you know, Charles Bronson, Elizabeth Montgomery, they had a good chemistry together, and you know, that's why I rated that one highly. And I could see with Rick, too, you know, giving it a 5. That's fine, too.
They walked off into the sunlight. You know they did it. You know,
I give passerbyers a 4 or 5.
And
so,
that's right.
You know? I was the only one, so what could I say about that? Hey, I like Lincoln in that one, okay?
That was a good Lincoln that they had in there, yeah. That's my favorite president of all time, so I'm a big Lincoln fan, so I thought they did a good job with that.
Good job, Rick.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like Bravo.
All right, Louis. Rick, What did you give it again?
Five.
Yeah, five. That's cool. Hey,
yeah,
right. All
right.
That's a,
remember,
all
it's
right,
intelligence
right.
for today's
you
show.
Set a five. All right. There, now we got a little, yeah, little you know, diversion here. We can't all be giving us the same things all the time. All right, Louie.
Okay. The way I see this episode is it's actually a pretty generic episode. It's, for me, it's, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic theme story. It heads in a pretty predictable pattern. It's well acted. It's well told for the most part. And I was going to give it a, basically an average review of maybe like 1.5 or 2. What kind of switched it for me was the ending monologue that John Anderson gives.
And I like that.
Yeah, and the thing about that thing is that he
I'm not sure
exactly how it goes, but basically he says that humanity's biggest flaw was faithlessness. And I thought that really I had seen hints of it and that kinda like hammered it home for me. I think to a certain degree I mean the thing is that this episode requires that you make a lot of assumptions about exactly how they survived and how everything worked. But then that kinda I think we're supposed to ask ourselves to have a little more faith in what we're seeing. I mean, when you think about the episode, I mean, it's weird. I'm not sure what Rod Serling's religious views were, but in a weird way, I got the impression that he was kind of saying if people had only believed in John Anderson and took what he said on his word only, if they believed, you know, with faith, like you know, in some ways that computer in the cave, I think, was supposed to be like God. I mean, there's a scene where James Coburn talks about he's run into all of the people, and people are howling at the moon at one city and another city. They built the statue out of some metal, and they're worshiping it as their god, and he's calling them all nuts.
Yeah.
And then we come to the end of this episode, and it's kind of like, well, if they only listened to John Anderson, this nut, they'd still be alive.
Yeah.
So it's this weird, I get this weird feeling that, and the thing is, it's weird because, because usually with this kind of episode, it's kind of like, don't trust the computer. Oh, the computer is messed up. It's going to lead you down the wrong path, whatever. You know, but in this case, the computer was right and the people were wrong. And for me, it was, but it's weird because I can't believe Rod Serling was saying, like, trust computers and live your life by them because they're, I don't know, emotionless, passionless, whatever. So,
Well, the carrots at the beginning was a good example, Lou, about, you know, and also there was a few jokes thrown in this episode, like, you know, he makes the comment, well, were these left in a will, or, you know, I hated to see the ones that didn't make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did these grow, Evie? Or did somebody leave them to us in a will?
They were the best.
The best? I just see the worst.
But, I mean, you know, that whole idea about having faith, or being faithless, being a flaw, and the main flaw of humanity, and what causes our downfall. It was an interesting point of view. In some ways, I mean, John Anderson was kind of like Moses. I mean, he was in the cave, was like, you know, the mountain. He's up there, and
he
talks with God, then he comes down with his messages,
and everyone
they're
just
supposed
like
to
looks
listen,
at him
and the minute they don't listen, now the wrath of God comes upon them, they all die.
Sure.
And the earth swallows them up. It's just a, I saw the religious allegory there, and it really was hammered home with that last speech by Anderson. But yes, I wonder where Rod Serling was really trying to.
That's a good analogy, though, Louis, because I never thought of that. Yeah, the Moses thing, where you know, because he comes walking back so slowly with this look in his eyes, like he's seen God. You know, and the same, like when Moses came down from the mountain and he has this look in his eyes, like, you know.
Oh, yeah, you like Charles Messman, I forgot.
Exactly. Like, you know something we don't know.
Yeah, and basically James Coburn is, what's his name? I forgot the actor's name.
You're probably Edward G. Robinson there.
That's what James Coburn is. He's the one leading them astray. So I don't know. For me, that kind of turned it for me. So I kind of give it 2.5 because it made me actually just start thinking about these kind of things. And I guess that's the mark of any good episode is that it actually starts getting your brain thinking.
Yeah.
So while it was kind of, you know, for the most part, it's generic. You know, and I, you know, it was told very shorthand. You make a lot of assumptions, and, you know, I like the quick cut from the moment they destroy the computer to the next shot, with everybody being on the street dead. It's kind of like, yeah, okay. They're not going to beat around the bush. They died. And we all know the only person who's not going to die is John Anderson's character. So,
poisoning from the nuclear war, I think he'll eventually die.
Well, you know, I think the impression is that...
Well, she's going to eat now.
I know. Well, he could eat the horse, but I think the point is that. But, but the point being, I think, is actually that John Anderson. I think, you know, John Anderson's job was to keep these people alive. Now that they're dead, his job is kind of over. His purpose is kind of over. He's like, nobody learns. So I guess that's it. You know.
But now he's got to survive, and he can't eat.
I don't think that's important to him. Actually, I think it was more important that he delivered the message of the computer. And now that everyone died, it's kind of like his purpose is over. I got the impression that him walking away was him basically walking off. You know, it's like Shane. You know, except the one was there to say, "Come back, Shane." But he's just walking off, walking off into the sunset to finally just die off. You know, I really think at that point he had given up.
Robert, we can't have him eat Mr. Horse.
I know.
I don't even know how they kept the horse alive. I mean, they were all starving.
Yeah,
the horse pulling a car. It's like,
horses need a lot of food. Horses need a lot of food to stay alive. What the heck's going on? Oh,
I mean, you had to make assumptions of the subs. You had to make assumptions that there was probably a river with clean water, and they were rationing their food really tightly and all that stuff. And maybe they were growing some food that did grow and some that didn't. Admittedly, the episode makes a lot of assumptions. You have to make a lot
of
assumptions.
A lot of suspension of disbelief, right?
Yeah, or just a lot of assumptions about exactly how things happen. You just have to accept the fact that they're surviving. And like I said, for me, I think the episode is more about this idea of just, you know, the idea of what we should believe and what we should put our trust in.
Exactly.
I mean, it's weird. It's weird because I don't think Sterling was necessarily, I mean, I don't know. For me, I was really kind of debating with myself exactly what the message was here. I know it was a warning. I mean, I realize now as we were talking that basically the war had started in 1964, which would be a year from the day this episode aired. So he was saying, like, in a year, the world's going to be bombed, and then 10 years later, this is how it'll look like. So he was really contemporizing this episode.
Sure.
So, but, you know, I know he set it off as a warning, and, you know, the military always plays the bad guy in post-apocalyptic movies. It's like the guys with the guns are the ones that are going to start taking control anyway. I mean, that's like a given in a lot of these post-apocalyptic, post, you know, these anarchy worlds. You know, it's the guys with the guns that take control, and then you got to fight against them always. So, but like I said, it's just the idea of how, you know, what's key to our survival. Is it faith? Is it faith in God? I mean, I believe in God, but I thought it was an interesting message for Fraud Sterling to push forward.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a belief in humanity. I'm not sure. But then the computer was the thing they had to believe in. So it's like, I don't know, for me it was like jumping around with
it was just
exactly,
something to believe in.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Just something to believe in. It's kind of like, you know, there was a movie called Serenity. And the idea is that you just have to believe in something. It doesn't matter what you believe in. Just believe, and that'll give you strength.
Just something that's going, to keep you going. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I give it, I give it 2.5. I thought it was a generic story, but that ending speech really just got just started making the wheels in my head spin.
Yeah, I know. I did like the end speech. I really did. I thought that was very good. Okay, Ken, are you here?
Oh, yes, I am.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Ken. All right.
And I have many words and thoughts on this. One thing I just have to say, no one should ever say they put their mind on null and void if they like something. You like what you like. And no one should, I think, ever be apologetic in saying that something isn't worthy of enjoyment. No one so hooray for Rick for loving it, and hooray for anyone to not like it. But no one should ever say, well, that because one person's trash is another person's treasure, and it's all good.
Right.
You know. And I haven't really thought that much about this episode. It isn't one that totally grabbed me, but it is a great episode for getting people to get
opposing viewpoints and thinking, you know, what is Serling getting at? And his aspect of faith and thoughts on that. If you look at his writing and a lot of his writing and his personal thoughts on things, well, he definitely does not believe in blind faith or the irrational or false gods. You know, that's I think, a given. His religion, I would say, would be humanism. Now, was he personally deeply religious? I have not read that aspect of him, but I wouldn't consider that man from his writing would be an atheist. I don't think someone, I mean, look at the obsolete man. God, that is a story of such faith in that. You look at that, and it's against the state.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, and to me, if there's any a five star, it's something like The Obsolete Man, one of my favorites. This episode, well, the good, John Anderson, boy, he's fun in anything he does.
He's absolutely great.
You're almost great to play the John Anderson drinking game. Look, there's John Anderson in an episode of Classic TV. I mean, was it 11 or 12 times in The Rifleman? And I love Rifleman. I mean,
Bonanza
and stuff. Rifleman, which is a trip. I looked up how many times he does things, and he played a different character 2 weeks in a row on the show. I think it was that he was the grandfather.
Luke's the son. Actor, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think he played Lincoln or something in the next episode or something.
You go check IMDb and you see how long his catalog is.
Yeah,
oh,
it's amazing.
God.
I have
everything.
Yeah.
Oh my
and
God.
He's so versatile and he's so good. Coburn, a joy to watch. John Marley's really good. So right there, I'm going to give this at least 3 stars. From just watching the interaction, the bickering, and the headbutting between these people.
Yeah.
The story, well, I don't know if you can put holes in it or not, but look at it. It works as allegory. Look at the time. Dave mentioned this. Others have mentioned this. Look at the time it's taking place. It's the Cold War, which almost blew up in our faces during this time. John Kennedy is about to be assassinated in about a year. Computers are used, but they're on the hands of controlling the buttons and the weapons of war. So there's something that mostly people fear. People will turn to religion against science at this time, being very practical. So it is really fascinating from that viewpoint. It's a thing of having faith. The religious symbols are just blatant in it. I mean, the Moses analogy is very good. He's the acolyte. He's the John the Baptist, Moses symbol, John Anderson, going, you know, to visit the Holy One, who is going to tell them how to survive in this post-apocalyptic world. Now, of course, it could have been played two ways. It could be the demon symbol who lies, like the Howling Man, and in there it's like you better have, you know, deep fervent faith against something like that to defeat it. Or it could be manipulating people. So you have the rational, the military mind coming in here against so-called irrationality.
Irrational.
Faith, and yet you're saying that the faith is what's going to save you. The faith is really the rational. In this viewpoint, because the computer is going to have the savvy, the knowledge, the technical know-how to help these people survive. Now, it might have been better if instead of maybe that's the key to it again. The world's been destroyed because of computers, because of the military, because of the weapons of war, which are linked to computers. So John Anderson had to construct this lie. He had to construct a God symbol to save their asses, to be blatant about. He had to do that because he had no other choice. Because right. if he told the truth, I've got a computer in here, and that's the only way we're going to survive. It's going to tell us where the food is, where the proper drinking water is, where everything is. It might have been better if they were, like, eating actually animals and saying, well, this is the Badlands. This is where we know the bombs fell. This area, this water's clean. These plants aren't poisonous. These are. Maybe society has even broken down more, that you don't have anyone with the logical knowledge of herbs and plant flora and fauna, etc., and knowing, like, that mushroom's going to, you know, kill you and that one's not, etc. So,
Ken,
yes.
You don't mind if I interrupt you a minute, but
please.
You said Candy's killed the next year. I think he was killed in November 22nd, 63.
Well, right.
And didn't this air in 63, this episode here?
Well, when? When exactly? I'm not looking at the dates or not. I thought it was earlier.
Dave, did you say
I don't have it in front of me.
Aired in November of 63?
Okay.
Yeah, November 8th.
Yeah, it aired 3 weeks before.
Yeah, 3 weeks before,
yeah. Yeah, 3 weeks before. So you're getting right on the cusp of fear and Vietnam's going strong, etc. So all
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No, not at all, please. So all these things going on, I'm gonna give the episode 4 stars just for the sense of realizing when it's happening, the time, the place it was written, what's going on in Serling's soul, how he had to fight like the Dickens to get everything made into allegory, to get his philosophies down, and
right.
to get these things on the air. I'm going to give it a 4 for the acting, for it, the interesting concept, and, you know, just being, you know, very good television, you know, that I cherish.
For
to me,
time.
To me, yeah, for giving it for its all. It's not utterly brilliant, Twilight Zone. I mean, that, you know, we discuss, you know, other weeks and things, you know. We'll
get to those. We all know how much Rod Serling butted heads with,
oh God,
you know, the bigwigs. I mean, he.
Yeah.
It was almost like unbelievable how they locked horns on everything he ever wanted to do, and you know he was lucky he got half the stuff on and he did.
Yeah, yeah, but you know I think if you took Anderson and Coburn out of it, and Marley out of it, and you had lesser actors, I'd give it maybe 2 stars.
No. Yeah.
It's that you had, they're riveting to watch.
Top notch.
You know, and it's
yeah,
like, it, you know, all in all, when Twilight Zone's at its best, it's not just good television, it's great theater. I mean, that's the way it's written. And I don't know if you guys have said it or not, it always is less is more with Twilight Zone. The hour ones just didn't grab me in the
no.
same way.
There were very few that were really, you know, ones that you could remember and you could say, hey, they were pretty great.
They seemed a little padded.
Yes. I mean, out of all the hour-long episodes, I can think of 3 or 4 that I actually loved. You know, like the one with the wax figures.
Yeah. The George Gizzard one. He's the robot.
Oh, yeah.
In his image.
That was the first one.
Yeah, that always
yeah.
got me. That one always got me.
Yeah, and and the one with Martin Balsam with the wax figures.
Yeah.
The
museum one. That one I loved. But, you know, other than that, there weren't many. And on Thursday, we leave for home. I thought it was very good.
Yeah.
No, but you don't have many. The hour-long ones are too padded.
But it's really interesting, I mean, just from this, because it easily could have been reversed, that faith in this computer, you could easily write it that could have killed them. Because from this episode, if someone asks you, what are the political, religious views of the person writing it, you couldn't exactly tell. Because someone who is, like, of a conservative bent and very faith-based could say, well, this episode is saying that, you know, you have to trust in God, only in God can you trust, and that's going to be your salvation, and this is what's going to save mankind. And you can take the totally opposite point of view and go, no, no, it's a computer that really saves them. It's technology worshiping things like the military and creating a false god. If he would have leveled with them, then that would have saved them, because it's technology that's going to save you. It's the rational mind that will save you, not blind faith. So,
right.
You know, it's interesting from that point, in that it kind of bounces both
yeah.
ways, yeah. You know.
No, yeah, I think you're right, because that ending could have gone either way. It could have ended with, you know, the people surviving, the computer being wrong, and kind of a tragic
yeah.
view of John Anderson's character, and that
yeah.
he
yeah,
had
yeah, yeah.
Been leading these people
yeah.
astray for so long, and was it his own... you know, blind faith that was causing it.
Colossus, the Forbin Project comes to mind, in my mind, of like the computer's gone real bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's a science fiction, usually the computer is the bad guy.
Yeah.
He's the one, you know, because the machine has no soul, so therefore
yeah.
it really can't yeah. care for people or make the right decisions. But in this case, it flips it a little bit. And that whole question of faith pops up.
Oh, I wanted to thank Guest 9, because Guest 9 said to the cornfield. Maybe that's where the children went. They went to the cornfield. Thanks, Stephen King.
And Barman 54, I'm glad you showed up. You've been here through the whole show and you haven't said anything, but
no,
at
that's
least
me.
You listened. Oh, that's
yeah, that's
you?
Me.
Yeah,
oh.
I just wouldn't be able to get
oh,
the phone. Barman 54 is yes.
Oh, well then, I take that back.
Warning, warning, nothing but nonsense from this point on.
All right.
Oh, and Felix gave it a 3. Looking
yeah, Felix
in the
gave
text
it a 3.
Yep.
Barman 54 as you can?
Yep.
I thought you were guest 10.
No.
Well, we thought he was guest 8.
Well, we thought he was guest 8.
I am mysterious. I duplicate myself. Just guest day when I'm on call to him. I change my number, my identity, all that.
Are you a bartender?
No.
Just asking, barman. For
he wishes he was at the moment, though,
doesn't he? That's just me last name is Olivar.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. Well, then.
Now, you're getting that confused with the TARDIS Tavern, if anybody ever listens to the TARDIS Tavern, about two drunk guys talking Doctor Who, so.
I have also been known to be extremely cuddly at times, too. I haven't told.
Cuddly Ken.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we got Cuddly Ken, who is giving it a 4.
Yes.
A 4, right? Okay. And Robert's 2.5.
Yeah, I give it a 2.
What
I said it's an average story. The acting's great. I enjoy the acting. Just
all right. 2. And Guest 10. Well, Guest 10, I'm glad you're here. But if you want to throw in a rating there, you can. And Rick, of course, you gave it a 5, and that's cool. And Sergeant Tim, oh, it's a shame Sergeant Tim left. We would have had a military man here. And and Louis, you gave it a 3, right?
I gave it a 2.5.
A 2.5.
Oh,
okay.
And by the way, happy Memorial Day for all the vets out there. Just,
oh, yeah.
And Surrey
yeah,
military
happy
as well.
Memorial Day to all of you. And Bobby gives it a 2.5. He gave it a 3 originally, but he changed it to a 2.5. So we'll let that go. And who's left? Wait,
nobody.
Southern.
No, Dave.
Southern,
right? Did you say
no,
Dave?
No, Dave.
I gave it a 3 because of the acting. The story of 2,
you
but
3
because of the acting.
But wait, Barman is Ken. Who's Southern California?
Ken,
when you're on the phone, you don't show with your internet with your name.
Oh, okay.
You show us where you're phoning from.
Yeah.
Oh, you're just trying to confuse me. Okay.
Yes, I am.
All right. Okay. Well,
Guest 9 gave it a 2. Looks like. And
Guest 9 gave it a 2. Oh, cool.
Now, Guest 10, we're doing 1 out of 5. If you're thinking it's 1 out of 10, you give it a 6. That's still pretty good.
That's cool. Hey, I'm cool.
Whatever your rating system is on that.
All ratings are valid. All ratings are valid. Nothing is null and void. All ratings are valid.
And I have to say, I don't want to rock my boat, but really thinking about it in the whole entirety of Twilight Zone, I have to give it a 3.5.
Guest 10 gave it a 3. He
got
to
knock it down
it.
A half.
All right. That's cool.
It gets its graces from the acting a lot.
Give it jelly chicken. That's what you want to give it.
That's right.
You give it a jellyfish or a jelly chicken. That's
Listen,
right.
For Elizabeth Montgomery, I'd eat a jelly chicken, I tell you.
These are all good ratings. This is great. All right, well, Robert, you're going to have to help me out here now. Of course, I always need your help at the end. Yes. Sit up, stop lancing around and messing around.
Hey, I'm slouching over here. Okay, I have a right to do that in my own place.
Don't be lounging around here. I need help. Okay, the 7th, June 7th.
You're right, yep.
Okay, is our next episode. Is it Uncle Simon?
Yeah, unfortunately. We go with a computer theme again.
Okay. And I forget who's Is that Cedric Hardwick? Is that Cedric? No, not Cedric Hardwick.
Robbie the Robot.
Yes, it is.
Cedric Hardwick. Constance Ford. Yep.
Who?
Constance Ford.
And who's
Cedric Hardwick, Constance Ford, and
Cedric
Ian Wolf.
It is Cedric Hardwick. Okay, I was right. All right.
I'll bring the cocoa.
I'll be the robot's the star of it.
Well, that's true. He is.
I'll bring the cocoa.
And the popcorn. No, I love Cedric Hardwick. I really do. I think he's fabulous. He was one of the best British actors, but I hated him in this. But anyway. That's okay.
He'd make a real good Scrooge, wouldn't he?
Wouldn't he be a great Scrooge? Yeah. So, okay. So, on Saturday, June 7th, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we are going to talk about Uncle Simon. And let me tell you something. You all better be here. Because if you're not, he's going to get pissed off and he's going to come after you.
Well, Lynn, let's go ahead and hear what Rod has to say about
That's
Uncle
right.
Simon.
That's right. Did
real
you
quick.
See what Uncle Simon did to his niece? Yeah.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Next on the Twilight Zone, the distinguished Sir Cedric Hardwick lends us his considerable talent along with the very accomplished Miss Constance Ford. They appear in what can most aptly be described as one of the shockers on our schedule. The play is called Uncle Simon. And this we submit as a relative you've never met before. It's a story with a final curtain I doubt anyone can predict. Next on Twilight Zone, Uncle Simon.
And there you are.
A shocker. A shocker. Oh, boy. As you love that, you like a shocker. That's a shocker in my head.
I'm shocked already.
My shocker. Anyway, yeah, Uncle Simon. So, and you notice he says Cedric Hardwick. It's Cedric. No, I love Rod Serling. I love him to death. Rod Serling is my God. Rod Serling, he's my idol. But sometimes he annoys me when he says Cedric. It's not Cedric Hardwick, it's Cedric. Oh, my God. But he's not alive anymore. Yeah, there you go. He's not alive anymore, so I can't correct him, and that pisses me off. But anyway. Okay, everybody. 2 weeks from now, I'll go sign with Cedric Hardwick. Okay. And we will see you all then. We will see you all then, won't we?
No
yes,
comment.
Lynn.
Yes. Yes, Rick.
No comment.
Rick, you better be here. And Louie, I know I'll see you, Louie.
I'll do my best.
And Ken.
I'll do my best.
All right. You all better be here. Or I will send Uncle Simon after you. All right.
Sent him after Dave. Oh, that's why he's here today.
Dave, you better be here now. You missed a couple.
And make sure everybody has your Mr. Smith line ready to go for next episode. You baby of can hit her. You know, trying to get a Mr. Smith in there somewhere.
Oh, God. All right. Hey, everybody. With that, I'm going to say adios. Have a great, great weekend. Hey, have a happy Memorial Day.
You too.
Same to you.
Okay.
You too.
And we
bye
will
all.
See you. Yep, bye all, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be? So live madness and free, desperately in need of some stranger's hand. In a